go to thecognitiverampage.com. Keep fueling the change. Help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support. Love you.
The Cognitive Rampage, a scientific approach to self-discovery, change, and life optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast again. I hope you're taking care of you again. I know you're living your Cognitive Rampage. We just switched over. We typically broadcast live from Facebook now, and we did for a little while, but I could not figure out how to add him and him being our guest, Zach Rhodes, who will be on. Zach Rhodes. I always sound like I'm saying Rhodes. Zach and I are going to talk about addiction, but just prefacing real quick that we were live on Facebook for a while. Didn't work out, but the link is posted there, and hopefully you're joining us from that page. I'm double checking that link is live and working. And welcome to the show, Mr. Zach Rhodes, man.
Thank you very much. It's really endearing that you waited an hour for me so you could take care of the technical difficulties, man.
Yeah, my technical difficulties on the back end. Yeah, we're working. Good. We're alive and we're working, brother. So we are alive and good. I want to put these comments on, too, in case anybody wants to comment here that's watching live. And wants to ask us any questions. But like I said, a lot on the intro on Facebook, man. Just for everybody that's listening, Zach's the host of the Social Exchange podcast. I'd rather you just go there and listen to it. Talks a lot about it. But what would you say, brother, that the Social Exchange is about, man?
The basis for it was supposed to be that, you know, in studying addiction, I got just interested in social concepts in general and the way that we have, I don't want to say debate, I want to, the way we have dialectic about conversations. You know, the most useful way to have conversations about something in good faith, you know, like that you actually want to make a change or you actually care about what the other person's going to say, which is, it sounds so cliche, but there's some wisdom packed behind that that makes it not cliche. And that's what the show is supposed to be. I catch myself a lot of times using, you know, we have our confirmation biases and all that shit. But I, you know, I try to correct myself as much as I possibly can. I did come into contact with that recently. I'm about to launch kind of almost like an NPR sounding, like a radio lab kind of sounding narrative piece about prescription painkillers. And I did find myself kind of charging through the narrative. I obviously have an opinion in the episode. I'm rationalizing that by saying that there's a difference between having those conversations one-to-one, which are supposed to be the basis for those is to change each other's mind, and I'm wide open to it. Doesn't always work out. I guess the basis for a narrative is to teach something or instill something. So anyway, that's supposed to be the basis, that's to have a political conversations that make sense and are constructive.
Yeah, that's difficult to find on social media or even in life, man. Just to be in line or have a conversation, you got to be, it's like, I can't say this politically. I can't say this. You offend anybody. And, you know, how do we get through things without talking about those things from both sides when, you know, we put up our red and blue flags and we go, oh, nope, that's left, that's right, that's this. We can't get by our concrete thoughts. And, you know, you bring up something huge that, you know, a lot of people, it's hard to do, which is check yourself. You know, I'm 100% bias on my view about addiction treatment, and I've been rather skewed that way, even to my own fault, man.
You have kind of there's some emotional salience for you, I suppose. It's what I like about your, you know, you in general, the reason I got so interested in following you, I saw Stanton on your podcast. That's how I knew about you. But when I heard the story that you were, you know, you do this stuff like life coaching, which some people get there from having not having the skills, and then they present themselves as a life coach because that's something they can do. You went the opposite route. You developed all of the skills you possibly could need to thrive in that world of mental health and realized that there was something dishonest about it. So you left it. Yeah. And that's something cool about you and cool about your group too. I was watching the last few days, your group and people who post on it. It's like, I'm always scared to go live because even, you know, I jumped on Twitter the other day. I try not to even go on Twitter anymore, except you kind of have to advertise. Yeah. And I was in good faith sharing a study. And, you know, so I didn't even say a word about it. I just shared the study and then people are jumping on me. And I'm like, damn, man. So you can't go and say anything live. If you offend, you can't think out loud anymore. And that's exactly what you're doing. I guess that's the whole basis for your thing.
I appreciate the love, man. Yeah, I definitely go wrong. I'm scared to go live on the tribe, dude. I mean, the people are cerebral. They'll challenge you kind of like your social exchange group, too, you know, that can have a conversation. For the most part, we can have a conversation about certain things. And
yeah.
That's why I encourage everybody to go live, is because that moment where you're just left to your own thoughts without the social filters, without anything else, it's a fucking rush.
Yeah, on one hand, you want to keep that private sometimes, but... On the other, I do like how people post shit all the time on your group and just without any apology. And basically, if I'm reading it right, it's like, if you do it in good faith, you're forgiven for saying anything dumb or silly, yeah. Or I don't even think you would call it that. I liked the one the other day, the guy, whoever it was, I think he was driving a truck, like, take your tribe to work day. That was fucking hilarious, man.
The legend. Tim Drugan, the legend in the Drugan family, man. Him is a funny cat, dude. He's a cerebral cat, too, but funny as hell, man. I was watching it, too. I think Patricia was like, it's like one of those weird movies where it's kind of like a scene where he's just playing the music, doing the truck thing. That shit was hilarious.
The funniest part was I watched his work day. Sorry if I'm creeping you out if you're watching the guy. I was like sitting there like, oh, man, this is dumb. And then like an hour later, like, oh, still is, you know.
Yeah. Weird, man. It's so weird what goes on social media, what doesn't go on social media, what even I find myself going, why am I watching this? Or whatever it would be. You know, it's weird how the human is pulled to its own, sometimes its own devices, its own interests and where it goes. And I'm going to make a terrible segue for on how sometimes addiction links to that, right? I had it was a counselor told me that she believed the drugs that people were addicted to call them on purpose because they relieve something.
You mean like the drugs have some like ineluctable calling or draw to them?
That the drug of choice, as it's said in addiction facilities, the drug of choice becomes the drug of choice because it generally symbolizes or reflects a direct issue with that person. Like the specific drug is because of anxiety, because of trauma. But then she said it in kind of a way, and that's the doctor now, said it in kind of a way of like, well, the drugs that, you know, that they get hooked on call to them because it does provide them something. It's relief. It's what works. It's what's calming the nerve or the anxiety or the depression, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, people have been given a pretty fat single lever to pull where they can't go wrong. If you say shit like that, you're fine. You know, no one's going to jump all over you. At least if anyone does, it's a minority. Whereas if you give that a little bit more thought, just any amount of human effort to think about it, you know, that you're in a dangerous position. So like I'm about to say, I think I'm probably safe around your listeners, but you know, of course that you get something from the drug that you were craving and that works out for you until you get some other thing that suits your craving somewhere else. Just like, what a leap to say that there's some sort of a chemical demon, you know, inside of there. You know, it's just, people find it friendly that, you know, it's just what we hear now and there's no basis for, I'm preaching to the choir, I know, but just ranting, you know, there's no basis in history, in the laboratory or epidemiologically to make that claim. It's all just a matter of what our culture was up to at the time. And that is the most serious case of cognitive dissonance that I have encountered since I've been studying, you know, social topics in general. I come back to addiction as one of the more interesting standard stories that people cling to and can't seem to escape. You know, they're all over, but it's one that once you have that revelation, you can only see the damage being caused by all the people who haven't had the epiphany. Mm. It's a strange time.
Yeah, I think it happens to somebody, you know, directly. When sometimes I walk people through it and you go, what would you do, right? Your son, your wife, you know, your brother, right? They go through it. And what's the first step? You know, most people go, well, shit, what would I do? What would you do? Would you take them to rehab, you show love, right? And then you got to show strong love where you can't enable. So I can't help you out. You can't stay here. Don't get any money. But then it says when people are dealing with depression and addiction, support them, reach out for them. Right. But then they have classes that tell you not to do so. Right. And when you really get to choose, like, what do you do, man? You know, what's the average person do right now in addiction?
I'm not sure that I know. What does somebody who is experiencing an addiction do?
Yeah. I mean, typically, like, you know, maybe you got some friends and family or whatever that looked at, or maybe they're just alone, right? And they're just going, all right, where do I go? You know, what do I do? As the way the system's set up now, basically, is what I'm saying, the typical walkthrough.
Yeah, well, I think usually people who are doing something at all about an addiction have been told that they have one. I'm not a person who claims that the addiction's not real. I think I'm writing with Stanton right now. I think it's a useful concept and can only be really useful if you take away the drugs only mandate and you can be addicted to an experience of things. So I think a lot of people come to the idea that they're addicted to things because they come into contact with the law or some other force or, you know, an antisocial kind of a setting. And so in that sense, people are tending now, as you I'm sure well know, to revert to methadone and Suboxone, which it's crazy. It's what a tough conversation to have, because I absolutely laud the harm reduction approach to Suboxone and methadone. In fact, my wife works in one of the great methadone clinics, I think, in the country, the Chittenden Clinic here in Burlington, Vermont. So it's really tough for me to say, but I think that people, it's like MAT, Uber Alles, and that's what you know, if you have a condition, that's one thing you can do and you won't be judged as harshly as if you go kind of file what used to be moral bankruptcy and go to a 30-day rehab somewhere.
Yeah, you said a lot, man, in those words. I mean, the idea that they've been told they have an addiction, right? And combined with the society that we live in, right? There's so many ways of whether it's almost enforced as an infection, almost as a disease that's been preached. And, you know, you mentioned the social concept too, right? And where people go, the self-harm stuff is, you know, I was pretty direct and hardcore on Rogan when I, you know, talked about Suboxone. And I obviously generalized when I said, it's the same thing, but it's not the same thing. But what I failed to say is that most overdoses come from people that mix drugs. And so when you're on the Suboxone and then you end up getting off of it because you can't afford it or you don't want to do it, can't find a doctor, then it's back to the heroin. Then you start crisscrossing drugs and you have an issue. But the harm reduction, self-harm, I mean, if it's making you not kill yourself every day with a spike, then, you know, I should have said that. You know, I'm a fan of whatever works for you. But it most of it continues to feel like a Band-Aid that leans more to the disease model of treatment of addiction as opposed to a social treatment model mixed with a biochemical model of treatment. You know, you also said that you're writing with Dr. Stanton Peel now, which is huge kudos to you, brother. I think that's so neat, man.
Yeah,
that's cool. What's the name of the book?
Well, I'm going to break the rule because we were talking about, we've been talking over the past like 4 months about almost publishing. So He called it not too long ago and was like, hey, man, the book's going to be old before it's published if we keep ancient about it. But there's a book called Outgrowing Addiction. And it's uses my background in child development and makes the argument that it's a parallel concept. It's human development is addiction. It's the very same thing he wrote about with respect to love. Actually, not really love, but love relationships gone awry. And when he wrote the book Love and Addiction. And so we just make the case that, hey, are you worried about your kid having an addiction? Let's back up for a second. Do you ever worry about your kid in other areas of development? Let's think about a few of those. What's the process like? And then we generalize the principle and we say, why is, you know, we make the two arguments. Development is this. Are you with me? Yeah. Okay. Hopefully they will be. The addiction is this. It's kind of, you can deprogram a little bit, and we're soft on it. And I was like, well, it's not a disease that you can't escape from. At least you can admit that there are better and worse places you can go with your addiction, at least. And it's just a balancing act. And when you put them together, you have to, if you have granted those two things, when they come together, you have to make a big move to continue to say that addiction is something different than human development. We'll just have described the very two same processes, and we bring them together and then ask the reader, can you tell me the difference? You know,
that human, that geez, man, that's a well captivated in short sentence. I mean, the fact that human development is addiction. Expand on that a little bit more.
The way that we, I say we, but you know, he kind of beat me by 40 years, but talk about addiction is, and by the way, it's the reason that he and I connected. You know, I had a podcast, I talked to him on it, and he was awestruck because I didn't realize that, I knew that I went against, you know, the current in a lot of ways. I didn't think that what I had to say about addiction was exactly in line with what he had to say. And I think he was starting to believe that maybe there wasn't a soul out there anymore who might agree with him. And the way that we defined it is exactly as a life experience, you know, an experience with an involvement or a thing that someone becomes wedded to the extent that they continue to do it despite net destructive outcomes, you know, but, and they continue, they can't seem to cease. And so there's an interesting phenomenon there, and a great reason why someone might want to call it something like a disease, because it's tough to work through. He has kind of proven to me how to make that argument effectively in real time, as long as people care long enough to hear you long enough talk about it. He has a program called the Life Process Program. I've just watched as just pretty standard questions about, you know, sorting yourself out in different dimensions of your lifespan has helped so many people. It's incredible to me, you know, because I work on it and I'll talk to people and just ask them, what are your values? Okay, how are you behaving now? All right, how does that oppose your values? All right, what do you need to do? And like any epidemiological study will tell you, the vast majority of the people I work with just say, they kind of quit the I work myself out of a job. And then they thank me for doing it, but really they've just answered a few questions and got it together. I won't say that the severity of that experience doesn't come in, you know, gradations, but forget why I got on that topic. I had an ending point.
No worries, man. It'll come back. You know, we were talking about human development being addiction as an experience. And like you prefaced before, is addiction can come in all shapes and sizes, whether it's shopping or even sleeping, eating, sex, go down the list, even travel. Travel can be an experience, right? That you spend all your money on and you don't get to see anybody, you know? So, I mean, there's so many things that however we experience it, and look at the way we deal with relationships, the way that someone may be destructive through multiple relationships. They take that same addiction of behavior mixed with thought and all the other things combined, and they keep picking the same relationship or being the same person in the relationship. You know, I think this is kind of along the lines of what you're talking about human development being addiction, that, and to back up too, to also say that, I think we're so programmed for the magic pill. We're so programmed to say, if we can call it this, then we can develop a way to solve that. It helps with anxiety. I mean, when I was dealing with anxiety heavily, like hardcore, I wanted it to be medical. I wanted to go, just tell me I have cancer so I can stop tripping, and at least I'll know what it is. And then I remember thinking to myself, wow, I was willing to go to the extent to say I had something like that just so I didn't have to cope with maybe the social aspects, biological aspects, or anything else that may be adding to what was happening, when what I was experiencing in life would certainly reflect that. So I think it becomes easier, especially when I watch people in rehab for the first time and somebody look at them and give them some love and affection and say, hey, it's okay. It's not your fault. You have a disease, and yeah, this disease is incurable. And you have personal defects along with those diseases. And I watch the person kind of go, oh, okay, I have an answer for something now. This is what it is, and this is who I am.
Are you religious at all?
I'm spiritual. I'm spiritual.
Well, no, I ask because, you know, it's like the God of the gaps phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's hard to sit in uncertainty, you know? And Fair enough, man. I don't like to either. And we all have periods of uncertainty that we just don't have the bandwidth to sort out. And so telling me that I have a disease, if that means that I can just rest, then that might feel pretty damn good.
I'm a practitioner and the placebo works for you and you're alive and you're shooting up less or drinking less and violent less. If that placebo is working, then by all means, dose it twice a day.
What's lost through omission there, though, and this is the thing, is exactly what you're talking about. People have to come into contact with adversity. And from that experience, you can go the way of not having ever developed the tools to deal with it, which means you have to hide from it. So how you do that, I don't know, because it'll come back sometime. Or you become better equipped and better equipped to deal with it. As I work in the school system, it's a hobby horse of mine to talk about this, but I don't want to sound like, I don't think it's the crisis of proportions people say that it is, but I do work with a lot of kids who they just can't sit in a point of uncertainty or fear or anxiety. They must have whatever it is that, and we give it to them. You know, it's like people blame the generation. It's kind of the way that we're raising them too. So there is a whole societal blanket around it.
I love how they sidestep that shit, right? When they're like, all the kids today, I'm like, you're fucking raising them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're the major influence on this millennial that you're talking shit about or younger than that. I'm like, you were the influence. Well, and our social influence, right? This is kind of the big thing right now that for me, what feels like the front lines of addiction, the Gabor Mate realm, if you will, the idea that we all have trauma. All trauma is linked to addiction, pretty much, period. And that trauma is expressed in the addiction. And really what it is a full lack of social connection.
Yeah, well, what do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's a good way to pinpoint some symptoms that come along with people that experience that life experience of addiction. Sure, but some people aren't. Some people find their social connection in the addiction. Is I'm hanging out drinking with my boys, or I'm shooting up with my bestie. You know, I mean, wherever that becomes, that social connection becomes there. So if it's the starve for the social connection, but I also know users that isolate. They say, stay away from me, and they'd have their own island and their own government if they could, and as long as the drugs came in, they were cool. So, I mean, to say that that person is lacking social connection, if they had the social connection, my answer to Gabor Mate about trauma is, well, fuck yeah, trauma is variable. It's subjective on the level, and I want to say trauma is compared to what? I mean, a perfect life that's not real. I mean, so we have trauma on level. So it sounds good. One of my favorite lines, but it sure sounds good to say that, you know, all addiction is trauma or something that wasn't fed. Very Freudian too, because it's linked back to mother and acceptance from the parent or the mom in his longer speeches. And we can study a lot of people and see that their social connection is certainly distorted. It certainly could be what we call not normal, which again is subjective. And sure, it may happen in some, but I see people very socially connected that use every day and people that isolate when they use. So, and to say trauma is a base for all addiction. Okay.
Yeah, people do that. You know, I think that he means well, I think, but I went to a workshop that he did after I read his book, whenever that came out, and I was so excited to see him. And there were a couple parts in that book that I had just flagged, I'd actually bookmarked and thought, I want to talk to him about this. And he probably means something different than how I'm taking it. And the trauma, you know, the big piece where it's like, it all reverts back to trauma. I wondered about, and this is when I was in my infancy of studying the concept. Before I asked the question, he does this trick. And have you ever been to a conference of his? I don't know.
No, I just his videos and a couple little things online and stuff like that. And his book, of course, but not the never in a conference.
Well, you mentioned Freudian. Yeah. And he does this for, you know, how in psychoanalysis, the trick is your memory is suppressed and, you know, well, I don't remember that. Aha, see, it's, you know, it works. That kind of a thing. So just unfalsifiable. And he did that in to the detriment of somebody who was going to the training. So there was a guy, he challenged, can anybody in the room tell me that you have an adverse experience, had an adverse experience in your life, and you have mental illness or addiction now, And you don't think that your adverse experiences caused it. And so, well, that's a big ask, but a lot of people raise their hand. I raised my hand right away. So I wanted to see what he was going to be up to. But what he did was, you know, he like flambéed this guy who was sitting there, and he was asking him questions about his kids. And he was asking him, well, how about your childhood? Did you ever get bullied? Oh, yeah. Did you talk to your parents about it? No, because I didn't want to bug them. Oh, well, maybe your kid, something like, you know, I should be careful not to take him out of context. I can't make sure I want to make it sound worse than it is. But it was something like, oh, maybe your kid's going through the same thing right now. And so at the same time as he wrapped it all up in one package and gave it to him on a bow, which was your adverse experiences. Trust me, that is what caused all your shit. Well, and then also, you're probably doing the same thing to your kids. And that turned me off. That's a pretty dangerous thing.
Well, you're implanting memories or false memories that aren't there. And then that's the one thing you cannot do as a practitioner, much less in front of an audience and to a person you don't know. And then wrap it up and go, yeah, and hand it to them and say, yeah, certainly trauma that you've repressed, as you've stated here, tells me that the reason you have addiction is because of that suppressed trauma, most definitely. And that's now being reflected onto your child. So there's some more anxiety and guilt for you to wear.
Yeah, and that makes it tough for me because, like I said, you read the book and very, very refreshing in a lot of the ways that he talks about what addiction is, what society's like. He's a smart guy. And I think that he's come to believe that he's right, down to every statement that he makes. And that's that. And I think that it's harming people enough that utilitarian argument that some people make where they say, yeah, I don't believe that either, but you know, look at all the good he's doing. I don't know. It doesn't sit very well with me. So,
yeah, that was kind of my even approach toward the 12-step idea, right? Is look, again, I'll preface by saying if somersaults work for you, by all means do that. But like you said, when I walked into it and I saw dishonest stuff and a treatment method that had no empirical data to back it up whatsoever, and this was the first approach, you know, and I would just get the second degree. Oh, it helps a lot of people. It works for a lot of people. I said, but nah, you also can be hurting people. If yeah. somebody can't find their, I actually heard a therapist tell their patient to make a tree a higher power. Just make something larger than yourself. So just make some shit up you don't believe and put that up. And I thought, man, I don't quite know the science behind it. Not that I would not God either, because there's tons of research out there that prayer and meditation and all these things help people mentally, and they create a positive attitude. So heck, I can't prove that shit with science either. other than it works for some people. But when it was the only method approach and it was forced down people's throats, when it became this is what you have to do to be here or you don't get the social connection, I'm kind of like, oh, now you're hurting people. Now you're hurting people and you're telling them that they have a disease that you can't prove. You can't show me an x-ray. You can't do a brain scan. You can't do anything. You can't brain map it and be like, oh, here's addiction. And you can't even prove this thing in this collection of experiences in our human development.
The tell of a program that I want to stay away from is that the program itself, and you know, addiction is, if you want to say cured, but I mean, it's managed through culture, I think that's basically correct. You know, it's not, you can't make a program unless your program is subject to change, the way culture changes, the way things change, the way our understanding of the world changes, you know. And if you are a program that has any, at any point you're unwilling to budge, that is the definition of dogmatic. And it's an overused word probably to talk about anything that you don't like, but that's what it is, you know. So dogma is harmful. You know, if you can't change your mind about something, then what you're saying tacitly is that I don't care if you find out something that's correct and I'm still wrong. It doesn't change, you know.
Yeah, that you can't just ignore it. And you're right, when you hold on to that, and more importantly, even as a patient or a person, as an individual deals with the addiction itself in their own mind, not to take that dogma and not to just say, I can't change, it's a disease. And for me, any approach that comes out the box telling you that it's incurable, any approach that comes out the box telling you off the rip it's scientifically proven a disease when it's not and just ignores that science, and then tells you that it's based because you have personal defects and an addictive personality, and these are the things and the only things that can help you because there is no cure. I'm sorry if my first one is, no, fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you would be a good place to start. I'm thinking about, when you're saying that, I'm thinking about kids that I work with who, they can't express themselves the way they want to, and to not be able to express yourself just kills you if you're a person who kind of needs to. So I work with a lot of kids who just by temperament are intellectual people. They will thrive if they are in a space that being intellectual and talking, ask me how I know, and I know that you're probably the same way. They'll thrive if you give them that. On the other hand, they know that by the time they've come to see me, a lot of times, they have done enough things wrong that they don't want to make waves. And I think about that in addiction treatment too, where there are things that we tell people that they know damn well are wrong, but wouldn't dare try to make that wave because what they're doing is trying to figure themselves out with good intentions and good faith. I think a lot of times people just don't have the capacity to take on another challenge at the same time. So what, you're going to go try to sort yourself out and butt your head against the system at the same time? You know, you're already going in there, you know, with a deficit. So it hits me emotionally because now that I think that we are writing this, I think about kids every time now. And I think about my responsibility myself to help instill in them the skills that they might need. I should say, allow an environment that they can flourish in. And I watch people just not doing that. And not only not doing that, it's not just the sin of omission. People go further than that and make it impossible for that environment to happen. And I don't know, man. It's hard for me to know where to go sometimes. It's exhausting trying to have conversations slowly and without butting heads against people.
Yeah, that's where, you know, some of Gabor's stuff leans in, right? Where the environment that's provided, right, and what we come up in, what we're influenced around, you know, has a lot to do with it. And you know, my book, I was writing it because I was saying, you're all right. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of this. It's all of it. And we can't just say it's this one thing. We can't just think our way out of addiction. You got to behave differently. We got to check our biology. We got to check our environments, our environments in our own head, our environments out there. It's everything. It's not that you have some disease thing that you're stuck on. And look, I don't want to take away from that person that is experiencing whatever they believe to be real. But what Leo would always tell me, man, my mentor, is, bro, it is what you believe it to be. And that's a powerful thing, man. And if we believe it to be an addiction, if we believe it to be social influence, if we believe it to be these things, now, mind you, there are some biological, needs that happens with the body and the mind. Once we don't have it anymore, we can develop those biological ones. Sure, no doubt. But we know it's a little this and a little that. And it seems like we have so much ability to be able to help kids, especially at the young age before it gets there. Like you said, they thrive in that kind of environment. And when we're forced into, you know, boxes of how we're supposed to be, how society's supposed to live, what you're supposed to achieve, what you're supposed to get, I think this speaks to what you and Stanton are writing about, is how that is just our development. And with those influences, we feel stress, we feel less than, and we find various ways to numb that out in some way, man. But like you, man, I've been talking about it for so long, I think in the wrong, even going to where, what's the fucking answer? I'm going to, right? It's, we know it's not a disease. Well, then what is it? You know, what is it, what we're doing? And I think what I'm getting from you all is it just is. It's just the development that we experience here.
Yeah, it's a very non-satisfying quick answer. You know, it's not a quick answer that makes it so that you can't schedule a soundbite and pass it along. And so what we're talking about is what you're saying. I mean, on one hand, you as an individual can make good of different aspects of your life. And if you can just give yourself a moment to feel comfortable enough thinking about it for long enough, you're probably going to be all right. If you care to move forward and get the stuff that you need, you can improve all the time. On the other hand, we're making a big ask, and I don't even know if it's an ask, but just a statement that something huge, you know, a paradigm shift has to happen. The way that we think about these things socially, culturally, politically, will have to change if we're ever going to accept or even come close to accepting a legitimate answer that is just, it's part of your lifespan. Addiction is whatever your life space is. And if you're in a place where you are engaged with something to the extent that it's doing you harm and you're having trouble getting over that, whatever the hell it is, you can call that an addiction, and that can be useful to do if what you call addiction is this very broad thing that we're talking about, where you can build yourself up and you know that you can escape it. It's not like, it's not a thing, but it's a good way to describe something.
Yeah. I think that symptom search, the narrowing down of what we experience, you know, I mean, look, I would argue that working 5 days a week out of seven is probably detrimental to your lifespan. And your physical health at some point, you know, depending on your job. If I'm sitting down my 5 days a week and 8 to 10 hours a day, then sitting down when I'm at home during those 5 days, and maybe I'm active 2 days a week, I'm going to say it's probably detrimental to your life. And couldn't we call that an addiction? Well, no, it's necessary because we have to pay the bill. We got to provide. We have to be these things. We rationalize the addiction of work. Is this just a part of culture? And I think this is where we're walking more into the realm of, I think, you and Peel, right?
Yeah. I mean, that is one argument people make. It's like everything you do is an addiction. You say, oh, no, it's not. Because you described it very well, but people missed that part of it, that you do what you have to do to live a balanced life. And you get to decide, am I on the positive side of the balancing act, or do I need to do something to get there? So if you're working and you know on one hand that could be detrimental to your health, it's the best thing for you right now, and it doesn't bother you, and that's, you feel like that's about where I can be right now to be the happiest I can, I'll reevaluate later. I don't know that an addiction concept is useful there. It's nice to have it on hand.
Yeah, and it's applied a lot of ways through the addictive personalities people think they have, right, to the detriment. And I like, it's just your life experience now and then. And people, I think, drugs are an easy target, right? I mean, that's why the government did the war on drugs. It's this easy target that people think they can manifest in their mind and go, the drugs are the problem. A lot like Dr. Carl Hart would talk, right, is that we're talking about the symptom. Drugs are just a symptom. They're a tool. Hell, we use caffeine every day, right? They're tools that we push forward, but drugs are bad. Drugs are bad. Take away your Aleve, dude. You know, take away all that other stuff that anyone else has taken. You know, I mean, it's all the drug, right, is the other argument, that it's all drugs. We've been using since we were a kid. We've been causing our own adrenaline spikes by spinning in circles, and our uncle's throwing us up in the air in the pool or something, right, hanging out. Just any of this stuff, we create our own responses to these things that either harm us or don't, or like you said, we make the trade.
He crushed it, by the way. Here, he came to my area recently, and he gave, I don't know, I guess just recently he started to go rogue, I think he called it, where he's like, doesn't just say I used to do drugs or I have done drugs before, that might be a good option for me. No, he has a standard joke that he does where he's like, he used to say, I drink alcohol, I have to go to all these functions with some boring ass people, sometimes alcohol is the best choice. He did the same thing, except he admitted now, he's like, I was in, what was it, Switzerland? Yeah, Switzerland for a year. And, you know, there's a heroin injection program. Worked really well. Heroin was a good option for me sometimes. I'll do heroin right now. And his whole argument is that stop thinking that there's something demonic about it. Like, anything you do, you make a choice. You weigh the risks, the benefits, and you can do that. Why would there be a realm in which you couldn't do that? Like, you weigh everything out the way you ought to, but when it comes to drugs, you can't control it. You can't. Once you try to make that measurement or do that calculus, you're screwed.
And, yeah. Well, you hear the person, oh, I can't have that drink, or if I do, whew, it's off to the races, I'm going, right? Well, yeah, if you believe that, but if you're aware of that, you can change and choose differently. But I mean, why, Zach? Why do people grab on to that and go, oh, I'm an addict. Anything I touch, I get addicted to. And if I have it once, it's bad. But it's okay, though, because I will use some AA here. Hey, relapse is a part of recovery. I mean, so they even give you the way out of that treatment approach as a side note.
Yeah, that's true. I bet that is true for people. I bet it is true that they're just not getting to the other side of that equation where they explain to themselves what they already know is true. I don't know if you're up on, you seem to kind of know all the intellectuals, but I just got done reading Jordan Peterson's book. He's an interesting guy, man. I didn't think I would like it. I did. But
I dig a lot of stuff that he says, and there's a few questions. I think I posted on the Rampage a question toward him. He didn't respond, of course, but it was to him and to Sam Harris both, who love to debate each other. But I kind of I posed a question to both of them, and I'm a peon, so none of them responded. I get into his stuff. I see his worry. I can see the picture he'd want to paint about how scary it is and how the world's turning over. And I kind of go, what's your solution, man? Right? What do we do?
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing, what I got from it, and as you, I'm sure you know, is that you deal with things the best you can, and if you feel like you're not satisfied with the way that you're able to deal with things, figure out how to deal with it even a little bit better so that at least things aren't getting worse. And he makes statements like that, and then he backs it up with some pretty good psychological, you know, psychologically relevant speak. He gets into the weeds at some points. I got angry because I was reading it, and then, you know, any good concept would follow something about a union archetype and then God, and like, oh, all right, well. But the thing that I like about it, no, go ahead.
No, I was going to crack a bad joke about mental masturbation. I want to hear myself talk, but I figured, you know, I'm kind of guilty of that shit too, so.
Oh, yeah, me too. So I know he'll never listen, so I can just talk about him all I want. I invited him on the show too, and he got his, whoever works for him responded to me in like 30 seconds, just long enough that I knew it wasn't an automatic reply. But, you know, it took short enough time that I wish he was ready to tell people no. No, he will not go on your show.
Yeah, I ran into a little beef like that with one of Gabor Mate's booking agent ladies. And I'll leave it off the air. I'll tell you about it later. I came at Gabor really hard when she played off an interview we had scheduled 6 months in advance. Then she blamed me for not having the thing.
Oh, come on.
But I banana tag all my interviews. It's a little plug-in you get. So I see when it's opened, how long they looked at it. Every one of them are opened and looked at by her email address. I sent pictures of it. I said, here, then.
Oh, man.
I said, why'd you open all of them then? If you said you didn't get it and canceled the show, you know, like 24 hours before we were going to go live.
She's so, opened it and said, nah.
Yeah. Yeah. It just said, nah. And I was like, okay, fine. And I think I did a couple posts and videos kind of going at his theory, you know, kind of going, all right, let's talk about your theory here, man. I was going to be nice. But I forgot. I scrolled this off there, that stupid comment. But I forgot.
I actually, for some reason, remember. I was going to say that one thing that Jordan Peterson says in his book, I'm not in the business of quoting him all the time either, is so simple that you would think, well, that's the worst advice I've ever had, because if I could just do that, I would. But he says, you can stop doing the things you know are not good to be doing, or something like that. Stop saying, if you value honesty, there is some amount of introspection you could do at a very basic level to stop saying things right now that you absolutely know to be false, you know, and stop doing things that you know are opposing your best interest. I was like, well, yeah, if you could figure out how to do that, that would be the thing to do, right? But he does go into it and talks about how on the most basic of levels, you do this in your book a little bit too, on the most basic level, there are things that are happening. It's like a trapeze act going on just above our heads. And if you just look up long enough to be there, you can figure a lot of stuff out. It's pretty interesting. I feel like you beat him on the book. He wrote it at the right time.
I appreciate that, man. I've just recently gotten over trying not to be as bitter as I am when I hear people talking about kind of my simple theories and how the approach and all this. And I hear it now and I go, motherfucker, it's been hard to be like, I've been saying this shit for like 5 years, man. But I had to really step back and go, it's out there, dude. You know, like I celebrated hugely. And when I realized, when I wanted to hold up the George Bush mission accomplished sign, when I saw John Oliver in Last Week and Tonight do a special on the rehabs and focused on Florida, brother, when I saw that, dude, I'm in my bed like, woo, Like, yes, yes, because now it's on a larger platform. People know. And that was really, that was the mission, to kind of get that out there and kind of say, all right, I talked enough shit. And it got out there and people see it, man. And it's been hard, though, like you said, not to backpedal when I'm listening to him. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, man. I think that he packaged it up nicely. He sells the basic concepts in the form of memes. And then he has a lot of earned wisdom behind it. But I read your book, and it's like what you did was, instead of taking concepts that you knew people already knew and making them sound nice and easy to think about, you did that plus you did a little teaching too, or a little, you know, expanding on concepts in a way that I remember reading and thinking, oh, you know, I had not thought about it that way. That probably is true. And that takes a little more work. And so it's not an easy dinner table conversation in that sense.
Oh, I quickly became the guy you don't want at your barbecue. And honestly, dude, it fucked me up for a little while, you know, just because I wanted to grind that book out so fast. You know, I'd stuck in the room, worked and typed late nights. I was just like, I don't know. It felt, I don't know, like I was trying to help, you know, but enough about that I've talked enough about myself. But I want to kind of go back to that person, right, that's being affected by addiction, in quotes, that life, you know, moment, or where they're sitting there and maybe they've lost their job, right? Their health is fucking declining at a rapid rate. They've reached out for help, but those people have been through it with them before, and so they're no longer enabling. You know, where's this person go? Like, just for our system now, not where should they go, but pretty much what's this path like?
I think about that all the time. You know, places like in Vancouver, I just did an interview with Travis Lupik. He's a reporter up for the Georgia Strait, I think it's called, in Vancouver. He works where Gabor works. He lives right around there. And so he realized that he does all this reporting on the downtown east side of Vancouver that you may have heard of, and the place that they have the syringe exchange, and then they made it into an injection site, and the first one in North America. And he realized that no one had ever actually just wrote that story as a book. People reference it all the time. So he did that. He talked to people who were exactly as he described, on the streets, able to do nothing. He wrote about how they got together to have a collective voice to negotiate for their best interests. He made notice that people, a lot of times, the most liberal and well-meaning and sensitive, supportive people, the ones who you want to be arguing for you, are not always the best to do it, because while they may have the stamina, the means to be able to argue for you, if they're not actually listening to you, if they don't actually understand where you're at, they're not going to be able to argue for what you want. And that's what we're up against, is, like you said, there's a system of care that it's sort of just like the de facto method is you go into some form of what we call treatment. And that clearly doesn't work for people who are back out on the streets. So what Liz Evans did in Vancouver was accidentally, she's just trying to be nice to people, started the Portland Hotel Society. I think that's what it's called. Where people just got homes, and her rule was, or her lack of a rule was, if you do drugs, even if you go to jail doing drugs, I won't kick you out. And it wasn't like this political movement. It was just, I want to be nice to you. And they all realized after studying it, and it started expanding, that is a part of the life space that when people don't have a place to live or lay their head or be connected, motivated, have any kind of meaning, as you're well aware, that's the kind of place where doing a drug and maybe not being involved in life at all for a while feels pretty good. And that's what people can do some places if they're lucky. That's why I live in Burlington, made friends with our state's attorney here and worked with her a little bit, and the police department even, to push for a safe injection site here, which we lost in the Senate. But we're pretty good here. And, you know, I don't know where you're from. Are you in California? No, Florida.
Yeah.
So I don't know about where you're from. Here in New York and various places are pretty good about just taking care of people who live in their society. And those places, even though they can be misinformed and lead people into treatment that could help them to an extent, but not prepare them to take on whatever comes after that, you know, we do pretty good because we take care of our our citizens. So what Stanton would say is that you're almost always best off insofar as you can keep people from dying. You would almost always be best off to allow people to live life the way normal people live lives and help them create that life for themselves. That's really freaking hard, man, because that requires, we do things by departments. You know, you go see a doctor for something, you go see a construction worker for, you know, there are all sorts of departments. We're not used to one area of interest having anything to do with the other. And I guess that's what we'll have to do. You asked where do people go? I guess it all depends on where they're from and what, you know, what the people who are trying to advocate for them have set up for them. Otherwise, they go wherever they can get themselves to go. And my whole thing is that if I have anything that I can offer, it'll be not to try to bend society so much or go against what's already created that I fuck everything up, you know, but be there where I can to help people guide themselves. Cause I think that's just, we're going to find out, or I don't know how bad it's going to have to get before we find out that power needs to be with the individual to an extent. And people need to be able to create experiences for themselves.
Yeah. The treatment you talk about, I think, is why people lean toward this addiction as being this one thing, as being this disease, this one thing that we can just nip in the bud, right? The one thing that it has to be this, because then it compartmentalizes into our wonderful society of what this is. If you, like you said, you see the specialist, you go to the doctor, the cardiologist, you go to that little box. And so here's the doctor. This is what you're experiencing. This is the box you go to. When truthfully, addiction itself is a society issue. It's a local society issue. It's a huge issue globally, I would say, but all of it causes it, being jobless, being homeless. Like you said, that little bit of drink that guy drinks that lasts for 10 or 15 minutes, that works for then and for the now. And a lot of like Maslow stuff, right? If I don't have shelter, safety, and food, I can give a fuck about anything else I'm doing. And if I can escape those feelings and pressures for a minute, then drugs work great for that. That's what I would say, is that drugs, alcohol, these things, they work great. That's the issue, is they literally work great for removing us from our environment, from our societies, from our failures, for our own personal beliefs about our performance or where we should be. They're a great tool to get us there. And you mentioned it. You talked about a giant paradigm shift needing to happen if we're to actually really treat addiction. And, you know, it's kind of what I would say is treat the person, not the symptom.
You know what I noticed is that you got to give it to Trump. You don't have to, but I do in a sense, not because I value him as a person necessarily, but he did notice that.
That's when I slide out of frame real quick like this.
Yeah, see, Adam Lowry loves Trump. he noticed that we were playing hide the ball, and bait and switch is kind of just how we live now politically. Well, I can do that. That's what I've done my whole life. I've noticed recently, first I'll speak for myself, I have recently become much more interested in the basis for people making a decision or doing something politically or socially. Once I've started respecting a decision, when someone makes a decision, if they're doing it because that's what they think is going to be best for society, and if they find something else will be best for society, they would do that. Well, I value that. And so that's a values choice that I've added to my profile over time. They've got me to be friends with this guy around here. His name's Dr. Rick Barnett, who, if we just talked to each other at a bar, we would disagree on almost everything. It's so interesting. I'm writing an article with him right now about something that we both agree on. And so what we have both found is that we totally appreciate the other person because, well, we are that thing that I just mentioned. We want to do things that we think actually will help. And if you tell me that it might suck for me and I might want to argue with you in the moment, if you tell me that something else is going to help more, I want to do that. So maybe that's a better way to say it, man. I'm trying to figure out. You tell me someday when you figure it out, but trying to say how to explain this without saying things like paradigm shift.
Well, you, it's appreciating the other side, but knowing the fact that other side exists, you know. And for me, my flip was, because I get asked all the time, okay, Mr. Bitching about everything, thank God we actually have something. What's your solution? You know? Yeah. And so I go, okay, I'll provide a solution the best I can. Let's stop incarcerating people that are dealing with drug issues and putting them in a terrible ass environment. Let's try to provide them food, shelter, and safety long enough to where maybe the human being can get back up on its feet. Let's legalize everything for treatment. That means mushrooms and marijuana and everything should be able and open to treatment, because if we're theoretically treating theoretical disorders, then we theoretically can treat it with anything theoretically. So then everything and anything should be open, and there shouldn't be a method or standard of treatment that's enforced if you want to get help.
Yeah. Hard to beat that argument.
Fuck yeah. I'm running for president. I felt like I had that the other day too, about immigration too. I was like, why is this so fucking complicated? It seems really easy to me, man. And I don't know the ins and outs, but I'm like, amnesty, if you're here, you beat us. All right. Fair to you. You beat the system. All right. I'm sorry you can't get jobs. Unemployment's the best. It's been in a little bit now, so it's not screwing people too much. So if you're here, you're in. You got us. But you don't have to run across the desert anymore and die. You don't have to split up families anymore. You all stay here. You're good. All we ask is just check in. And when you check in, when you come by, how long you're going to stay, put this little tracking thing near you. And then all we got to do is find you. And then all those extra resources, they're no longer looking for anybody except who crosses the line from this day forward. Should be easy to find them if we need to. And let's help people if they're in the desert trying to cross. Let's drop them water and not throw them in jail and go, hey, why are you going this way, man? There's an AC route right here. You can walk right in and check in. And I was like, that seemed kind of easy to me.
If we allowed ourselves to be able to talk to each other long enough to get there, then we'd realize that the solutions that we want are pretty common, pretty much across the board. We were talking before about adversity. Well, butting up, you know, coming to loggerheads with someone you disagree with politically is huge adversity. It's really uncomfortable. But it's only really, really uncomfortable if what you want to do is get rote knowledge about politics, memorize it, and let that be your political argument forever. It's not if you can just do it. I mean, you can't be told what to value or what should motivate you. But if people can learn that it is in their best interest to value instead of the right answer, or a movement that has the label, you know, that wraps the label of something like equity or something like that around it, instead of just wanting that to fulfill what you've already been thinking for the last year and a half, if what you like is to be challenged in the way that you're on the team with somebody else who you disagree with about some things, and it's a game to get to the right answer, that's changed my life, man. And I'm, whatever I do, I'm just trying to figure out how to get people to make that conclusion for themselves. And it's hard.
When you were talking about that, I mean, we talked about political thinking and talk and memorization. Well, I think that comes the same way with the person sitting in the addiction treatment and sitting in that facility. Is they're learning the point lines of, this is what you say if you're an addict. This is what you do if you're an addict. I label myself as this. I have. And then we just tell a narrative, like you said, that's been told to us of who we are, Republican, liberal. We wear whatever patch that we've been branded as in order to have an answer for something, rather than, you know, like you said, or I've said a lot, is uncomfortable is where the change is. And if we're willing to sit in that uncomfortableness, holy shit, you know what I mean? We can open up and make, like you said, massive changes.
Yeah. I always think about I think I can talk about it now, but there were a few years ago, I'll just say, and I'll keep the timeline fuzzy. I worked with a guy, a kid who's agoraphobic. And I didn't even know what that word meant, but I guess basically he's afraid to do anything.
Afraid
to
know that
was due to a degree in psychology, but I didn't know what that was. I was like, what do you mean afraid of? It's like, well, yeah, he just doesn't even leave the house. Why the hell would you get like that? How does it happen? And the story I heard was that it was some kind of a chemical imbalance, and you know, that psychosis. And that was the basis for his decisions to do weird shit or to not go do anything. And it took only a few times meeting parents and seeing how he interacted with the world to realize that he was, I think, the ultimate version of what we were just saying to try to move away from. You know, every time there was something that he experienced that felt even a little uncomfortable, he would go to his parents would do it for him, and or he would move away from it, and he would be incentivized to move away from it, never incentivized to try to work something out, you know, not to have grit, to have motivation, or to just accept uncertainty and a little bit of failure. And it got to the point where, I mean, he was, the word coddled maybe is also strong too, because it was loving parents who were just trying to do the best for him. But he got to the point where he didn't think that he had to do anything. And then once he like, going to school one day and he realized that, oh shit, I have no backup plan right now. I don't know what to do. I'm going to freeze. And all I know is that I'm going to get out of here and I don't want to come into contact with this again. And it took not very long, but took me helping him gain some uncomfortable experience little by little to figure out that he can leave his house. I think about that in terms of politics, in terms of addiction. That's what it is. There's just experience. There's the way that we see the world and operate in the world. There is where everywhere we look, there is so much more around us that we're not seeing than we are. And, you know, perspective really matters. And if you're the kind of person who can help people generate a perspective different than what they already have that could help them, then that, you know, I'm with you. If that's what you care about. And if you're somebody who has a perspective and will try it, you know, nothing to get people to be pulled into your narrow vision of things, then I'm not. And that's my basic, you know, that's my basic outline for how I try to navigate all of these systems.
Yeah, I compare that too. It's even to the person dealing with anxiety or addiction, right? The choice that we make that works for now, which is, you know, I don't want to face the adversity of a panic attack in the car, so I just won't drive. And there, I have control again, and I've fixed it, and I don't have to face it again. And then we keep making the choice or the responses to those things in life that then concrete how we perceive it, how we believe, what we think is going to happen there. And, you know, I tried to stress it in my book so much, I was like, you know, first off, my roller coaster thing of going, look, there is no truth. You know, if you ride it and I ride it and there is no truth, right? We're both telling the truth, but it feels like addiction. It feels like hell to us, right? Because we fucking experienced it, right? We rode it. I was there, damn it, Zach. It was bad, Adam. You don't know, you know, and
yeah. The experience was real. That's like the one thing you can say was definitely real. Just the experience doesn't mean that there's something else to have been created out of that is also real. You know, which I guess addiction is what people would say that is.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And so we keep circling back to this person that, you know, is struggling with addiction or what they've been told is addiction or really just maybe what makes them feel good for the moment because they're lost in everything else, whether it's connection, performance, safety, food, shelter, any of these other things. So they're standing there. One, they try to walk into an addiction clinic. Good luck if you're not insured. If you're on Medicaid or Medicare, maybe you get into one of these places and now I'm stuck there for however they tell me how long. And you said it that it may help you in the moment. But once you leave this environment, that's not real and life happens again, they're right back there. I mean, I think the recovery rate was less than 2% at the rehab that I worked. And that's what would upset me is I would go, all right, this isn't a real environment. We're not really going to have you a nutritionist. You're not really going to have a treatment doctor. You're not going to have this group here. This isn't real. And 30 to 60 days means nothing. And you're going to leave here. And I could do nothing but put you in a halfway house.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. People need to generate their own experiences. You know, and if you tell them which experiences they need to generate, that's doing nothing for them. Yeah.
And instead of trying to, but it's hard, right? Because what resources do we have? I think it was my mom or my grandma used to tell me but I'm sure they got it from someone else. What we're doing now to treat anything, be that mental health or mass shootings or anything, it's kind of like antibiotics, right? If you know, you need to finish the 12 antibiotics to finish it, but instead we just give every group 2 antibiotics and go, there, now everybody's got pills and nothing changes.
That's a good way of putting it. I'm going to use that one.
Yeah, it worked out because I think that's what we're doing in addiction, mental health. We want to get everybody medicine, but the medicine we're trying to give them doesn't work. It's not going to work. It's a placebo at best, taking 2 of those antibiotics, and maybe it'll get a few and help a few, you know. So it's very hard, brother, not to knock what is there, because I don't want to screw that up either to where none of that's offered and people can't go anywhere either. And I think I did that when I went really hard at the idea of pill for a pill in this society, as our treatment was, hey, get off those drugs, get on our drugs. And, you know, I told that story of the lady who couldn't get her pain meds, but she was literally dying. And so people that couldn't get those medications are suffering because they can't get them now. It's even more difficult. I'm like, damn, I stuck to a narrative that was pretty hardcore and thought I maybe even had played into some of that stuff, man.
We all do. I mean, I'm just trying to think about, I'm probably doing that about something right now routinely. And I'm trying to think about what it is that I'm doing. Look, man, you have the capacity of just acknowledging that and realizing it. That's all you can do.
Yeah, try to pull back. So, I mean, so what are they saying? Let's walk through, like, on the front lines right now. We covered, you know, Dr. Carl Hartz, et cetera, Gabor Matez, but you talk to so many people, man, on the social exchange around this field that have insights from different fields, man. Can you kind of walk us through that? Well, they're saying this, and they're saying this, and they're saying this.
With respect to what?
Any form of addiction, of treatment, whether it's an AA rep or, you know, they're saying this, and it's this, no, it's this, it's this, no, it's that.
Yeah, everyone has their own hobby horse. You were saying, like, things are real to you. Things that are real are real to you. Yeah, that, on one level, if you can allow someone to sit in a place long enough that they can figure out what works for themselves, that's what I'm for. The other side of that is what you're saying, you know, people who will say ayahuasca, that's what we need to do. You know, there is a one thing that we need to do. And that's really all that happens is that all the arguments are basically the same. And there are a lot of people who are saying the same, they are trying to adhere to the same values, you know, the preservation of human life, well-being rather than suffering. It's pretty basic. But you get stuck on, so people who are, who think that MAT is going to be what saves us. Like, good, man. That means that you care about people enough that you realize that even though this is a drug that you're giving them, that they can develop some sort of tolerance to it, but do it in a routine way. So they're showing up and that they're getting, you know, their dose of the drug. They maybe even have some extra experiences there, maybe even showing up 3 times a day is the most routine they've had ever. And so there's some people who will use that calculus to say MAT. And if you try to say anything that's against MAT, you're a bastard. You're on the other side. You're a schmuck. And I've heard so many nuanced arguments against it for all different reasons that it's interesting to me. So there's a click there. I am doing a podcast now. I think I already mentioned about chronic pain patients and pain pill prescribing. And my basis for it was to try to get some stories, some anecdotes out there from people who are in horrible pain. It doesn't take many people that you talk to in horrible pain before you are immediately on their side. And you're thinking, well, if this happens to even one person by virtue of the healthcare system, then we've got to do something, you know. However, there are people I talked to that I didn't air them because I had to leave this part out where they were saying, why are doctors treating me like a junkie? I'm not a junkie. If I was a junkie, I'd get it. Now, don't prescribe me anything. Those bastards. But me, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. And it's like, oh, you are in pain. You do deserve it. And so are, you know, so too would somebody be who you're calling a junkie who are, you know, taking drugs for a purpose that they wish they probably weren't. So then there's a round two. There's a little crevice that people are in that they can't seem to get out of. And it's all because you have a label wrapped around your cause that says I'm on the right side of things. Someone tries to peel it off a little bit, then you don't let them in. And so there's that. There are some people who still, I'm so far away from this, but do you still hear people down there talking about, you know, 12-step treatment, inpatient rehab. That's the only way that we need to expand that. It's like, oh, okay. As those places are, you know, exploding with, you know, rife with maltreatment and fraud, and you know, what's the basis for them working? Somehow you have to be in a sandy beach somewhere to get well. So I hear these little islands of ideas, all of which have some levels of truth to them. I think one big mistake that we make is when there's a dichotomy, especially a false one. You take moral failure, disease. Oh, maybe it's a little bit of both. And it's like, that's the most wrong. It's not a little bit of both of two wrong things. And that's where people are living right now, where they say, this big model that I know is wrong and this big model that I know is wrong, I'm not part of that. I'm part of the woke group that says both of them. Man. And so however they find that both thing, that's where they live. And it's really hard to get people out of that house.
Ah, it's kind of like the person that observes and doesn't do anything is just as guilty as the people doing the thing to somebody. Is
you know, omission, yeah.
Yeah, it's worse, man. That's true. Where you say, yeah, it's sometimes a disease, and then when it's not a disease, it's definitely a social trauma that's happened to you.
Right.
They're both correct. It can't be that. And then if it's that, that's true, man. I probably am guilty of that somewhere because I try to argue both sides of any statement that I make in the middle of a podcast. So I try to go this. Oh, yeah, but true. But what about the back on both sides, man? And that's interesting. I've never heard someone say that, man. I dig that. The idea that the dichotomy itself is more detrimental to any forward movement of treatment or addiction itself, or even just in conversation, really.
Yeah. And so I do that too, because we all do. And if we didn't, then we wouldn't be able to think or speak, you know? So but I it's a tell for me when somebody says, I hate when people do that. I never do it. It's like, oh yeah, you do. You definitely do. The question is not, do you do it? It's when do you do it? Under what circumstances do you do it? And how do you correct for it?
Yeah, the picture you were painting as you were talking about the little cliques or factions, I pictured the elementary or middle school lunchroom, you know, where I'm walking in with my lunch tray and I'm like, well, there's the people that believe AA, and there's the NA people. They're not quite AA, and NAAA hate each other. I don't know if I'm – all right, maybe I'll look over here. I was like, who's this? All right, we got the cognitive behavioral people. All right, we'll go hang out with them. Or we got the social trauma people, or the, oh, it's strictly medical and these pills will fix. Oh, it's hereditary. It's genetic, and you have a predisposition. And I'll sit with those people. And really, when are we all going to talk together?
Yeah, that's the most frustrating part, is that we have this mechanism, this channel for doing it, and which is social media, and you use it so responsibly. You know, the way that you do, I think you do, at least what I've observed. Well, what I'm saying is that we should, in theory, be able to have that same experience that you're having, where you see all these different camps, but it's social media. So the idea that you actually don't have to worry too much about the interaction means that it's a good. It's a good laboratory for getting an idea out there. You say it, but then you can just turn your screen off. That could be good. And that's gone such the opposite way. Your incentive is, you know, if you put yourself out there and say something controversial, even if you thought it through a lot, the risk is that people are going to hate you, and not just one or two people, but like the whole world could hate you in just a couple minutes. Whereas if you say something stupid, or better yet, if you just jump on a bandwagon of people who hate someone else, that's really incentivized. That's much easier and much more comfortable. So it just pisses me off that we have this, like, if I was sitting in a room and I had to just distinguish between people who are making different arguments and use that to say, well, maybe I'll make one now. That's really scary, and fair enough. It's so much easier for me to try to explore this on some kind of a passive way of talking about things, where it's one to many. But you don't have to worry about the salience of nervousness or human experience or whatever. It just hasn't worked that way. I wish that it did. I don't know how we correct for that. But
in all our algorithms that really just show us our own people. So our own views are what gets shown to us. So over time on social media and this tool, I'm only going to see people that think like I do and talk like I do. Rarely am I going to see the opposite unless I choose to follow the opposite and look for that. And over time, so I'm really just preaching to the choir, essentially, right? As opposed to being in the face of someone who may believe it's a brain disease and be stuck on that narrative of non-scientific proof whatsoever at all, ever any. and we get stuck on that. And, you know,
we're chasing the wrong dog sometimes, I think.
What's that?
I think we're chasing the wrong dog sometimes. You know, we could spend a lot of time talking about why one thing is true, why something else isn't true. That's a useful conversation, but the what Stanton's been teaching me pretty well, you know, among other things, is that that's not you can spend your mental energy doing something much more effective, which is to talk to people who are with you in the sense that they want to operate in a way that betters themselves in the world. That's useful. And then you spend some time talking about why and what your basis is for it. But, you know, I do have a lot of talks about why the disease theory is wrong. And I spend a lot of time on that while the whole time knowing that it's probably not the most useful thing I could be doing. I could be generating a solution, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of why I took the turn with TCR here is, you know, I felt like I was too much down my bias flag of waving, you know, people are dying, no one gives a shit, you know. I felt I was just too focused on that and then wanted to kind of back up and go, all right, let's just create something that's
inspiring. Sorry, man, my computer's about to die. I gotta move to a charger.
No worries.
One sec. Here, I'm gonna leave it right here for a second. Yep.
Grab the plug and run. But yeah, to people that are still watching or waiting for the podcast, I don't have to do a long edit when I do this, so I put that together. It is really difficult to come down the rabbit holes that I came down and, well, let's see if this social theory's got some aspect or trauma theory or self-harm or harm reduction. I mean, to walk down all these alleys and kind of say, yeah, I see a little bit of yeah in a bunch of them. And it's hard to not be like, hey, why don't we all get together and kind of talk about it? Because honestly, the transformation I think that it would take is I hate saying paradigm shift. I know, like Zach, he's right. But it would take such a shift, so much money.
Good. I was just thinking, I hope I didn't leave any embarrassing shit around.
No worries. I was kind of walking down on how difficult it is to listen to everybody that has some good ideas and like we were discussing that this may work, that may work. But like when we become dogmatic, when we don't listen, it's frustrating not to go like, you know, maybe if we all got together and focused this. And then I thought, well, you know how fucking hard that would be to literally be looking at a system of treatment and literally having to go, we're going to have to dump $10 billion per state into this to be able to provide all of this, well, integrative care, you know, to everyone that needs it. And well, that's just a shift in the economy and the way we view it. And then the show Intervention wouldn't be so popular as it is, right? You know, it would shift so many things to where it's like we can't even visit that. So let's keep nitpicking, like you said, and I'm guilty of it. Let's keep nitpicking about what doesn't work and adhere to the group of what we believe works rather than, like you said, trying to find a way that just sustains human life and ends or lowers suffering.
You can let me know if I'm going to start ranting too much, but
no such thing.
Then we get into, do you have a system that kind of works? We have a hierarchical government body in the U.S. with channels to make decisions and check each other on. And a lot of people, you know, are having a hard time in the country. There are a lot of things wrong with it, but it's better than it's ever been. So we got that going for us. But then you get to those situations where you need to make a change. And it's quite painfully obvious some of the things that could happen to make that change. But like you said, that costs $10 billion. It's like, I'm one person in 7 billion people, what the hell am I going to do? So it would be easy to get on the bandwagon. But then again, you know, it's one of my students that said this to me, and it's like, I rode with this. Like, you ever think about how freaking amazing it is when you turn on your TV or, you know, you're just on your computer or your phone, and it's only when that thing turns off, like your TV turns off, and you just, the world owes it to you that you're watching it. And all of a sudden you have to think about like the different things that go into making a TV turn on, and you follow it back far enough, you start thinking, Jesus Christ. And then it goes into outer space. If you get a construction worker to fix the line down the street, it's like, we can get all that with expedience. We can pick up our phone and be like, dude, the fucking TV, man. So my point here is that things do with cortical thought, you know, and reasoning, and people being able to do it, things happen that are good and probably aren't always the things that we don't, it's not like a point and shoot kind of a thing, but our system is just going in the right way. So I interviewed Charles Murray not too long ago. You know Charles Murray?
Yeah.
And really what I got out, I don't really agree with his findings. although they're hardly as controversial as they claim to be.
For anybody listening too, I keep meaning to do this for a few things that we blow by jargon wise.
Yeah, so I keep thinking I'm just talking to you.
Yeah. Yeah, just if you want to update anybody or any kind of thing that we preface, I also want to go back and talk about self-harm with our harm reduction. I keep doing that with harm reduction. That's weird Freudian slip, right? I keep calling harm reduction self-harm approach. It's weird. But yeah, just kind of those small things. But keep going, man. You were saying.
I took a long road to get here, but.
No, take it longer.
What I got from him was that he was writing this book, right? He wrote. So for anyone who doesn't know, Charles Murray is a social psychologist, sociologist maybe, but he wrote a book called The Bell Curve, and the book was about, he was studying IQ across cultures, and then not only across cultures, but between sexes, not only between sexes, but between sexes of different incomes and across cultures. So he went, put the book out for peer review. And one of the things that people told him was that you're not going to fuck with race at all. He's like, no. And well, dude, it's almost like it's like patronizing not to. It's like, it's obviously there. And if you don't say anything, that's going to make you look worse than if you do it. So he wrote a chapter in his book about racial differences in IQ. The reason he didn't want to do it is because whether his findings were correct or not, and his basis for considering them was correct or not, his findings painted a picture that was not preferable for African-American communities. And so this is where it gets contentious. It's that if you understand statistics, maybe it doesn't sound so harsh. It also probably is wrong. But, you know, African-Americans on a large scale, according to him, score a standard deviation lower on IQ tests than white Americans. And white Americans score about a standard deviation lower than Asian Americans on the same IQ tests. So he wrote, I think, like 3 pages in one chapter about this. And really what he was saying was that IQ, that doesn't necessarily mean everything, but you know, it is what it is. And so he's like, cool, well, I'll publish it now and sure, it'll be great. You know, and he got, basically the thought was, well, he wrote a book about why black people are inferior to white people. And so that's followed him since the 90s, and he's had to, instead of people listening to what he was trying to say, I gave him half hour. So it took me reading the book in a half hour to understand that he was trying to do something reasonable, not on a basis of racism. And people just listened to him that he wouldn't have to do this, but for 30 years, he was just cleaning up the mess left behind by people accusing him of something who obviously hadn't read the book. So what I'm getting at there is that not only are problems, sometimes do they feel like they're too big to be solved, we also demand this level of politeness or respect if it's something that is important to us, that that doesn't allow people to think or speak in a way that would help solve problems.
And yeah, coddling the belief. It's coddling that belief that we have to, I mean, I went on that whole conspiracy theory about how positive psychology was coming out about the same time we had a disease model approach. And so it worked really well with psychotherapy that you could tell someone, hey, it's not your fault. You have a disease. We're going to be positive about this psychology. We're going to work down. And this played into the psychotherapy treatments and the long psychotherapeutic inpatient treatments. And it all kind of played together and worked down the wormhole of it, man. And whether it's a conspiracy, I don't give a shit. Whether it just happened to work that way, because it's gonna just pull what's ever, you know, coming out. I think a lot of times we don't, well, if we don't feel like somebody treats what we're dealing with the compassion or understanding that we treat it with, then they're just not to be hurt, and we shut them off and shut them down immediately.
Yeah, they must be acting in bad faith because they haven't come to the same conclusions that we have. So like that, we talked about Jordan Peterson. I don't know why he's come up twice. I try not to bring him up ever because everyone always talks about him. But that was his whole thing, is like, I'm teaching in a university. If people want to be called he, she, they, whatever, fine. Like, I will do that. But you can't make the law tell me that I have to speak a certain way. So that is something I worry about.
Didn't they pass a law in New York that you had to ask somebody what they chose to be addressed by? It was like a $200 fine or some shit.
Did they pass it? I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, I don't think they passed it, but it made the ballot, which was scary enough. Just the fact that it almost got voted on, that I had to ask somebody what they prefer to be addressed as their pronoun before I say anything, and I could be fined if I addressed them as he or she from what my eyes thought I was looking at.
So therein lies a huge problem for me, which is that I think if you go down the list of just values, you could pretty much, I'm a straight up progressive liberal. I would put myself at that. I wish that I could be in a place where like I didn't want so much progress to happen, but I do. All the same, and so what I'm saying is that people who want to be called whatever, of course, I'm sympathetic to everything. I don't want to be told what I can and can't say, and I don't care if it's something that, you know, makes it easier for me in that circumstance that people are saying you can and can't say. I worry that anybody should ever not be allowed to have free speech. But this is.
In the same flip, then I'm being then exposed or I don't know, hindered or hurt by the very same freedom that the person's asking for. Because if I have my freedom, that you want that same freedom, but you don't get it by limiting my freedom just to get that. That's not a trade off. And I think I'm gonna make a connection here too. But this is kind of what happens when someone does speak out against, say, AA or for AA even, or any of these other treatments. Is before any of the, let's listen to the competence of the person, the experience, it's automatically greeted with, nope, that's wrong. Science says, and here's the dogma of my science. And we're just standing around pointing at each other as, this is better. No, this is better. Aren't I the shit? I should do a conference where I come out with 20,000 people, which I got paid to do, and then act like I'm the guru guy. And this is the way to heal everybody. And then he shuts them down and somebody else needs a better brand, you know, and it becomes more of, we're looking at that instead of the progression, the moving forward of utilizing internet and everybody's theories and research to apply. Because like you said, it, for many dealing with addiction, and then even itself, it just seems like, oh, we have an epidemic now. You know, it's a thing that, you know, we can never get a handle on. There's always going to be addiction, right? I mean, every which way you see it. I mean, because truthfully, I would say, yeah, I don't think we're ever going to cure addiction. There's always going to be some manifest way of our experience where it's here, but we have this belief that we'll find that cure. And I think even that concrete belief keeps people from being open to, you know, other ideas of what addiction really is or means.
How do you handle that when something like when the CDC, you know, made recommendations to prescribe fewer pills, to prescribe less, and then agencies picked up on that and weaponized it? You go and you can come to people with data that says, how are you doing with that? You know, because prescribing's down, people are dying. How do you operate in that landscape to try to do what's reasonable?
Well, doctors, I also argue, are cornered. They're cornered too.
Yeah.
Between their insurance companies and the patient being able to sue them for non-treatment of something they knew about. I mean, doctors in the ER, I mean, private practices, they got guns pointed at them from all sides. I mean, we have fewer doctors going to school, fewer people want to prescribe anymore. More and more doctors backed out of being Suboxone prescribers or any kind of harm reduction doctors whatsoever. The whole world has jumped on the marijuana train, though. Every doctor wants to prescribe that all of a sudden. You can tell. I think sometimes you can tell. But if the doctors had a better choice other than to just give the pill, I mean, sometimes you just give the pill because, one, it may be what they need right now. And it really may be the answer for their pain, their withdrawal, or whatever they're experiencing. So how dare a doctor not treat the patient with something they have that could help their pain in the moment?
Yeah.
You know, but why not instead of, hey, have you talked to somebody? Have you been to an addiction clinic that's probably got a 2% recovery rate? I mean, there's got to be a better solution or better support, not only for the patient, but for the doctors as well. If prescribing is down, again, I hear the Johnny Cash song for all those fellas that are in prison because of the times. You know, because the times that we're in, they're doing 15, 60 years for just because the times we're in, you know, and now there's just people did 40 years for marijuana distribution. You know, this is ridiculous. And now it's a legal open trade, right? A victim of the times is what I think doctors are, what we're becoming, what patients are becoming. And then we all become victims, I think, to the social hysteria. So when the social hysteria hits all the way back to the war on drugs with George Bush Sr. calling the war on drugs and turning this, that social hysteria started then. It continues on social media. And then the brands have to adjust accordingly or they lose sales. And then the doctors have to adjust accordingly. So the social hysteria, I think, is a major issue that they have to deal with. And, you know, a lot of times it's left to the doctor to where you're looking going, hey, man, this person really is in the middle of a shit life that they maybe should be in a facility or should something like that. And hell, if I can give them the pill and it helps, great. You know, overprescribing down and deaths up. I would tell you if I had just threw a rock at the glass house, I would say our society is fucked up. And I'm summing this shit up. Our society is fucked up. And what we're seeing are symptoms of it all over the place that we keep calling different diagnoses. We call it bipolar. We call it depression. We call it violence. We call it CTE. We call it what we call it. And we keep looking for some easy, simple to find answer. When I think our society, our way of life is sick. I think it's infected by so many different social stereotypes and schemas and constructs that what we're seeing is the human going, and something pops up. You know, it's like growing plants in a weird environment, or I spray random shit on it, right? It's going to grow a different color, grow left. And we're just seeing symptoms of a whole bunch of shit go awry that we just keep going, oh, we got another leak, boss. Instead of a whole new boat or fixing it, we just keep putting fingers in motherfucking holes going, all right, this works. And we're not realizing the whole shit's going down.
Yeah, that's really well put. What are you going to do now? So for me, my platform where a lot of people can hear me talk, but really where I'm asking other people what the hell to do, it makes me feel like I'm doing something to solve that problem or to at least do my part. Seems like that was true for you too, but you said you're taking some time off at least, or trying not to be doing so many shows.
Well, I think I wasn't even going to do the Rampage anymore. I had put it down that night when I put it down.
I'm honored to be on it then.
I'm glad you're on it, man. Thank you. And I hope you get a bunch of people that listen to Addiction and follow you, because trust me, people listen to Social Exchange Podcast. You know, for me, I'm starting to write the next book, Athlete's Depression, and I want to take a focus on this, but I want to do it differently. I want to be investigative and journalistic, not here and I'm proving it and this is it, and more investigating. And I'm also a little worried. I don't want to create the exact same thing I've argued, which is another hypothetical group of behaviors, thoughts, and things, and then call it something else. And now we got another little hypothetical, theoretical thing.
Yeah.
Call it. Yeah. And so, for me, I'm kind of going, fuck, I've been talking this long about how we got to watch the theoretical diagnosis and grouping of just normal human development into something that's maladaptive, and then go and do that and go and point that out. And a lot of what I've been talking about and discovering too, man, it weighs on me. It weighed on me. And so I get emails a lot from a lot of people asking to help them with things I can't fucking help them with. And I think that maybe I can. I can also be sued sometimes if I reach out and give advice, right, and try to help, and then I can come back and have a lawsuit, and then I'm feel guilty if I don't help, right, when somebody reaches out. I'm like, fuck, I've answered 8 messages. I might as well, you know, continue with this person tomorrow. Even there's had people I've messaged that've gone into 3 days, you know, of talking, and it starts to wear on my own life, and then I forget that shit, I'm not taking care of me, and I do feel like I got to the bottom basement. I think I'm at the bottom floor of the elevator going, I've seen all these fucking rabbit holes. I know what you're saying for the most part. I know what you're saying for the most part. I'm not the genius guy who can come out and articulate all the science and research, but I get the gist. And so I'm kind of looking at all the lunch tables, kind of going, I get the gist of all this shit. And frankly, none of you know a fucking thing. And I got to the bottom of the basement going, man, one more knowledge just brings more knowledge, brings more questions. The smarter I get, the dumber I know I've become. And as I keep getting farther, I just want to go, hey, turn this noise off for a little bit, bro. And I just shut this off. And I was watching how you were really diving down those rabbit holes, but then looking for answers in better places than I was looking for them. I was stuck on biases, and I brought on people that I wanted to prove my point of what I was doing, as opposed to opposing views. When on the social exchange, you bring a lot of opposing views on to your own beliefs and to even those you write with. And for me, I thought that's somebody that's in child development psychology. You're writing with Dr. Stan Peel. I said, man, this is the addiction toss right here. This is the guy who's going to pick it up and keep running, trying to find those answers or wake people up and take them that route. So the point of having you come on is really the last guest, because I don't plan on having any guests on the Rampage, really, unless I got a friend over and it's fucking fun. And I have a beer and we talk shit. I may do that again. But for the most part, you would be the last guest. And for anyone that has followed the Cognitive Rampage, who's, you know, listened intently because of my focus on addiction for so many years, I wanted to be able to steer them into someone else holding the torch who's running further than I did.
I mean, so much, man. You've done a lot of incredible things over the span. You know, there are few people who are obviously operating in the sense of wanting to make things better, and you're clearly one of them. So to hear that from me, that means a lot. Thank you.
You can tell my mama that shit, man, and tell my ex-wife that shit. You know, I mean, the truth is, man, is you know, I got a little perturbed too. I got not perturbed. I got influenced. This gentleman, who I'll leave unnamed, created the fifth podcast ever to go to iTunes. Has more downloads than I could ever imagine happening. I happened to run across him, and I was like, holy fuck, I actually listened to your shit like a long time ago. And he's like, and so before I'm 5 minutes into the conversation, he's read me off his resume, how much money he has, the lifestyle design podcaster guy. I got this on my property. I got this, and you could get it just like me. You know what I mean? That guy, in his arrogance, tells me how many downloads he has and how great he's, you know, X a million dollars a year on. I'm like, wow, man, that's great. I'm thinking, man, maybe I should listen to this guy. You know, he's got some tips, and tells me, well, your name is shit. Cognitive Rampage is shit. No one's going to buy that and download that. It's got to be easy. I want to name my stuff something cool. I thought, yeah, you know what, maybe. And I downloaded it for a while, and I started putting the pieces together to the fight life, and I'll switch over. And I said, holy shit, man. What the hell? I've been doing this for 5 motherfucking years. And then he was telling me, I'll teach you how to monetize it. I'll teach you how to, he go, how many people are in that tribe you were talking about? And I was like, 1,200, but we did just kick out like 1,000. So like a 1,200 now. And he goes, I'll teach you how to monetize from those people. And I went, in my head, I didn't say nothing. I should have. In my head, I'm like, I don't fucking want to monetize with them, dude. I'm not trying to make money on this shit. And if it sells a book, fucking great. I got to eat too. I hope it does, you know, but I'm not out to monetize it or make the tribe a change. You have to pay $20 to get to this group, to get to my workshop, to then pay for my membership fee, to listen to the other podcast. That's what everybody's fucking doing. And it, mind you, it's probably why they're all making a bunch of money at it. And I'm kind of just like, you know what? Fuck them. I'm doing this shit because I'm just trying to be raw, man. And you are going to do that anyway, just because you have a genuine, you're asking genuine questions, and you're searching for those answers and a genuineness to really help other people discover who have those same questions, man. And you do it with enthusiasm, but also with a cerebral approach that I dig.
Well, thank you. I'll see if I can keep it up.
Oh, you will, man. I trust me. I don't have that. When you interviewed me, I think what was the name of the Social Young Justice podcast?
Yeah.
I listened to it, and you have this very calm, you know, demeanor about you as you talk, where you sound very sophisticated and talking, and then I go off on some rant and I'm like, fuck, man, he looks a lot smarter than I do. Yeah.
That's how I feel right now.
What's that?
That's how I feel right now.
No, not at all, brother. You carried it perfect. You asked the right questions, man. And I tried to rattle you a few times on that podcast and throw you left hooks, man, and you didn't. But you do it with that same I want to put names out there, but I met some podcasters that I rolled with for a little bit. They were the best in the business. I mean, they're ranked up there with the Tim Ferrisses and stuff, and they're fucking in shambles, man. Like they're making money and they're killing it doing what they love, in quotes, but they're in shambles. They've lost their authentic self. They've lost their what they do it for, as I did, as I fucking got lost in what I was doing. It's so easy to, and I don't think that's going to happen with you, man.
I switched from that. I was trying to do the same thing. I started thinking, well, I should monetize this. And then I talked to Michael Shermer. You know, he's been on the show 3 times. And
damn, dude, you've talked to some killers, man.
Yeah, well, so that's the thing, is that I'm having this conversation. I think it was him. Boy, if it wasn't, then I'm sorry to whoever it was that gave me this good advice. But I started to, it was right after Charles Murray, so I think it was him. And I didn't get as much shit for talking to Charles Murray from like the left as I did for talking to Shermer about Charles Murray. And I mentioned it to him, and like asked, you know, it's a couple questions, and it was like, I was like, yeah, but I don't have enough followers for it to matter that all, you know, those people hate you. That's going to, you're going to wake up one day if you continue doing what you're doing, and that's going to happen. So I realized that it's one or the other. I either want to make friends, monetize, do that stuff, or there's a reason that I'm using the ability to be able to network that way. That's what I want to do, man. I don't want to be worn out at the end of the day thinking, you know, I was a schmuck all day.
Yeah.
I want to be worn out at the end of the day thinking, well, at least I did something.
Be raw and put it out there, man. And, you know, what I'd also like too is I happen to agree that if someone delivers a message more stoically and lowers the tone and slows the delivery, one can appear much more intellectual, much more cerebral, and get that point across to you. And I believe it because my mother told me so. And it became difficult for me to deliver this scientific information before halfway through the motherfucking podcast. I'm paging like a motherfucker. My bias is going off and I'm cursing up a storm. And I'm like, man, that's only so many people going to listen to that. And so many are going to cut that off. And you were opposite that. And you could go down a cerebral hole and really cognitively rampage, but without doing it so abrasively like I've been doing it about addiction and heavied in bias. And I think people need to hear it that way more than probably my way.
Thank you so much. Man, it just took me a couple times screaming about something, so sure that I was right. And then, you know, 2 months later to be embarrassed that's what I thought then, to decide not to do that anymore. Like I could always just be being an idiot right now about something. So I'm just, what I can do is think it and even say it, just not yell it and make an enemy that would say, ha, you know, when it happens again. But really I'm just a curious guy, and I don't try not to embarrass myself while I get truth out there. So that's the formula.
I lied. I did not start out curious. I start out really pissed off. I started really pissed and angry. I mean, heck, I did it today on my social media, on my private page, man, when the terrible customer service to that Greenberg Dental, never go to Greenberg Dental. They're a terrible dental service. You put your teeth, mouth, and experience at risk, and you may end up in the trauma unit.
I'm listening.
I went off today, man, and I thought, you know, even though I'm in the middle of doing the video, I'm kind of going, this may be a tad far. Motherfuckers be thinking I'm a little crazy. And I was like, you know what? Fuck that. This is what I want to do right now. She was rude. She was terrible and evil. And I'm going live and I'm telling on you. You know what I mean? I was like, just because, man, I don't know. I'm going to do that. And I'm probably losing thousands and thousands of sponsorship dollars because of it. And all of those great mentors I talk to that are doing podcasts that, you know, make mine look like nothing, we're probably right. And the guy I talked to there was probably right. I'm probably not going to make it big or make $1 million doing this thing. But again, man, it's the rawness and the realness that I try to just say, hey, it's my life. It's what I think about. And fuck you if you don't want to sponsor the show anyway. I don't like your shit anyway.
Exactly. Well, you have a way about you, man. It's like you're just kind of the same person wherever you go. Yeah. Plus, now it's everyone can see you doing it wherever you go and you don't mind sharing it. That's good faith right there. It's like I don't want to bring my camera with me when I throw a temper tantrum or, you know, I'm doing something away from after I've meditated, sitting down at a computer talking to somebody.
Oh, sometimes though, dude, that's the most humbling feeling is when you do a shitty, crazy rant video thing and you go off and then, you know, whenever it's calmed down and you're kind of sitting there by yourself and you go, fuck. You're like, what did I do? And then that moment when you get to sit in it, though, you're like, ah, I'm a human motherfucker, aren't I?
Like, yeah, that's like the most human thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah, like I fucked up. I did an asshole thing. I put it out there. But you know what? Fuck it. You know, that's what it is.
I'm perfect, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on. We chatted for a minute, man. But anybody that's listening, you know, the point was so they could hear you and we could walk down through addiction. And, well, if anything, I think we did today was open 10 other doors that somebody else didn't know could open about what addiction is or means and or what have you. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing that. And for anybody listening, please go to the Social Exchange Podcast and watch Zach and what he's been doing, what you've been doing, brother. I appreciate you being out there, you know, cultivating competence on all levels, man, especially around addiction and other things too.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to be here. I don't know what I did for the conversation, but it was just really fun talking to you. I forgot that there were forgot for a second we were even doing a thing. Like, I hope people are listening. It's like, shit, you're right.
I don't care if they do anymore. We haven't broadcast from YouTube in, I don't know, 3 months, 4 months. We haven't, you know, used the link. It's been Facebook. So we got it up pretty quick and got through. But any help that you ever need for the podcast too, man, just reach out, say what's up, and I'll be more than happy to help any way I can too.
Likewise, man, for anything that you think I can help with in any capacity.
You're helping every day with what you're doing, man. And I'm going to tell you, because a lot of people will love to reach out and tell you when you're an asshole and when you're stupid and when you should do this and do that. And they'll tell you how you should run your podcast and everything else, man, that probably don't tell you when it feels like, because I know it gets to it where you go, fuck this, I'm quitting. You know, I'm out. I think I've been there 4 times in 5 years, 3 in the last year to where I'm fucking out. But I come back, and I would tell you, man, I appreciate it. And for those that are in the woodwork that haven't told you, I'm thanking you for them, because they will come out of the woodwork and tell you eventually, dude. And keep pushing forward, man. Keep making questions. Keep asking questions. Keep bringing on the people that think they have the answers and question them, dude. You're really helping people, Zach. And keep going, dude. And there's love there, I promise, even if you don't feel it from people.
That's advice I've heard for a while. Thank you so much, man.
Cool, brother. Take care, man.